Thank you very much, Jennifer. Good morning, and thank you for the invitation to present today on your theme, water and its role in supporting WA's growth. Water reform in the four C's. Now, that's one better than the triple C, and I think you'd agree that water and climate change will remain topical and contentious for some time to come. But I think the burning question probably comes down to the fifth C, community. What sort of community do we want in the future? What sort of water future do we want? So I'm thinking beyond economic growth to a healthy economy, a healthy community, and a healthy environment. I'd like to start by taking a global perspective of the big drivers behind water reforms, and then narrow down to a WA perspective and touch on a few key elements that will contribute to water management beyond business as usual. Water reforms in Western Australia are largely a response to the Commonwealth's National Water Initiative. We are now progressing with WA's National Water Initiative Implementation Plan, which is consistent with the State Water Plan. And the thrust of reforms are really about inclusion of environment in water resources decisions, clearer government decision-making roles, acknowledgement of an increasing Australian government role, stronger focus on economic instruments, more focus on science and legislative reform. And much of this has been supported by the COAG Working Group on Climate and Water. But two standout drivers behind reforms are the continued population and economic growth and the decreased availability of water that has been influenced by climate change and a change in global water balance. Now, this graph shows what we already know. The world's population is growing rapidly, as is the level of economic activity, I think. But by 2050, Asia's population alone will increase by 1.4 billion. And the global water challenge is often described in terms of growing water scarcity, poor water quality, and decreased water availability. And our links to the growing economy and our internal growth will continue to accelerate the demand for freshwater resources. Professor Garnaut described climate change as a diabolical policy problem, elaborating, if we fail on the balance of probabilities, the failure of our generation will haunt humanity to the end of time. Pretty strong words. And following what the minister said, Lord Stern's comments on water strikes a similar tone and his call for markets to take a stronger role. And although both carbon and water markets will play a significant role in the sustainability stakes in the future, they will both take some time to develop and mature, and there are going to be some hurdles along the way. The idea that we are contributing to climate change, and for the most part it's not good for us, suggests to me that, A, we need to take steps to, A, mitigate the cause, and, B, to adapt and be well prepared for change. So how are we tracking from what the evidence tells us? The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change established a set of scenarios based on CO2 emission projections that range from business as usual, the A1FI, and the FI stands for fossil fuel intensive, which is the top red line, to the clean, mean, and green scenario, which is the bottom solid green line. And the scenarios are referenced to the year 2000. Current global emissions are tracking above the most intensive fossil fuel emission scenario, as we can see by the red dots. And emissions are moving rapidly away from the stabilization scenarios, for instance, the 450 parts per million scenario shown as the dashed green line on the bottom. So it's clear we're tracking outside the worst case of the scenario of the scenarios. Again, using an evidence base, we can see that global temperature trends are tracking outside the scenario envelope. It's worth noting that the warmest 14 years on record have occurred since 1990. The projections show that the 2 degrees warming in Celsius by 2070 for the most part in Australia, and perhaps a 3 degree warming is a serious possibility. Sea level change. For recorded sea level change, the trend is the same. The somewhat alarming 0.7 to 1 meter rise in sea level by 2100 from 2000 levels represents significant implications for Australian coastal communities. And a recent federal government department report estimates that $150 billion worth of homes, property, and infrastructure are at risk. The impacts of a declining rainfall trend in the southern half of Australia is now well known. The map shows above and below average rainfall for the last decade, the red showing below, blue above. And it's interesting to see that approximately 90% of Australia's population aligns with below average rainfall trends and probably provides a hint as to why we had to have the water crisis we've had. The wetter northwest has contributed to visions of opportunity with more water in the landscape, but it also represents the likelihood of greater extremes and severe flooding. And if we look into the future from all projections, there's a prediction from all the scientific institutions and the major models that perhaps another 15 to 20% reduction in rainfall is a significant possibility to 2030 relative to the 1990 baseline. However, the startling aspect of these observations is the rapid rate of change. There's already a 0.6 degree centigrade rise in temperature locked in with current emissions. The melting ice sheets, glaciers, have been noted to be above those projected. Ocean acidification, ecosystem changes, and so forth. Closer to home, a good way to think about climate change is that for every 1 degree centigrade increase we experience, the climate change shifts about 150 kilometres south. So by 2070, Geraldton's climate becomes Perth, and Perth's climate is somewhere south of Bunbury. And this will impact our biodiversity, human health, agriculture, tourism, and so forth. Let's go back there. We know rainfall in the Perth region is declining, and this is typified by the lack of wet years over the last 30 years or so. And this has resulted in a two-thirds reduction in inflow to the Water Corporation dams. Community knowledge of the declining level of water in our major metropolitan groundwater resource, the Nangara groundwater system, is perhaps less well known. The shallow groundwater system is actually called the Nangara Mound, and as the name suggests, the mound is a groundwater mound between the Swan River and Gingin Brook that rises about 70 metres toward the northeast. And the decline in water stored in the mound since 1979, as you can see on the graph, is about 700 gigalitres, primarily due to climate change, but also due to land management, private and public water abstraction. Knowing which policy and planning levers you can use with a complex system like Nangara is important when forging management strategies involving multiple and competing interests, including the interests of the environment represented by coastal wetlands. Now, what I want to show here, the wet and dry periods, we can see over time how Perth's rainfall has changed. And during the 60s, there certainly was 60s, centered in the 60s, a very wet period. Now, natural variability is certainly part of the climate equation. But secondly, what I want to show here is that much of our public water supply infrastructure and our initial water management regimes were based on assumptions grounded in the wetter period. The risk profile associated with the last decade or so, the last dry period, is typified by user and community conflicts, quantitative and qualitative uncertainties, and questions about the adequacy of planning. So how do we tackle competition in the water world, recognizing growing scarcity and climate change? I'll briefly talk about the environment, water trading, and competition in the water industry. inclusion of the environment in the management equation is now recognized. However, defining water regimes for important ecosystems, let alone the ones we don't know much about, can be difficult, and we often just don't have the knowledge. The introduction of water accounting will help to underpin accountability for management in the environment, and it also underpins tools like trading, water trading. But one of the notes from Eastern States commentary highlights the capacity of our institutions to respond quickly to changing circumstances is very limited, and no doubt this is an ongoing challenge. Water trading. It enables the exchange of water between water users and or the environment in areas where water is fully allocated. One way to visualize water trading and impacts of a variable and often reducing amount of water is the existence of two parties wanting to exchange the right to access water. This requires a defined resource and a water entitlement that represents the share of the available resource. The entitlement or share of the resource can be transferred at market price. But if the hydrologic input to the resource decreases and there's less runoff or recharge, then the amount of water represented by the entitlement also decreases. For this to happen, you need a clear definition of the resource or the consumptive pool and an assessment of the water availability that will change over time. And this arrangement needs to be underpinned by statutory water management plans and by legislation. My third point on competition centers on the Economic Regulation Authority's inquiry on competition in water and wastewater services that has promoted a debate largely that revolves around clarifying roles and responsibilities and promoting innovation. One of the main points was the creation or the proposal to create an independent procurement entity. In broad terms, the entity would receive from government a supply security and, subject to the security requirement, identify future supply shortfalls and seek ways to meet these shortfalls via supply arrangements and demand management options developed by the private sector and the corporation. Now, my reading of the debate is that it's not saying that the system is broken, because it isn't. But it is asking the question, are we getting the most out of the procurement process for the integrated water supply system in terms of options to supply and save water, given the changing circumstances of demand and resource availability? And do we have sufficient flexibility in the timing and nature of capital outlays for source development? The submissions on the inquiry are on the ERA website for those that are interested. Just a few words on capital investment. As far as capital investment is concerned, seawater desalination now forms the baseline for metropolitan water supplies. 8 new seawater desalination plants are in various stages of operation or development in Australia, and this represents a capacity of about 1,600 megalitres a day, or approximately 600 gigalitres a year. This is in the order of about a $10 billion investment in a world market that is well over $100 billion worth of desalination plants currently under development. And if you strip away all the pipes and storage outside the desalination plant, it costs about $1 per kiloliter to produce desalinated water, and the energy required is about 3.5 kilowatt hours per kiloliter. Capital investment in water supply infrastructure across Australia is occurring at a significant level. It's not just about infrastructure, though. Investment is happening in water efficiency, and the bits going into water resource management. However, the bulk of the expenditure is in infrastructure in the eastern states. And there is an opportunity for WA to mount a case for significant water projects to make use of the funds on offer. And you can see those sums are significant. Just to finish on cooperation, the linking of science to adaptation is definitely important. Science should inform adaptation and provide a solid platform to help policy and planning responses, including targeted at promoting behavioural change, such as the willingness to accept appropriate use of recycled water or simply meeting water efficiency targets. Science doesn't have all the answers, but we do have to make the decisions of the day with the best information available. And the Office of Climate Change is coordinating the state's climate science and climate initiatives, and the Department of Water is continuing to develop and progress programs to respond to climate change in partnership with groups like the CSIRO, BOM, universities, and industry are important players in that partnership. From a community perspective, a shared understanding and a shared vision are critical for effective water management. And as a closing example, the Nungera Sustainability Strategy, or the GSS, provides one example of a cooperative cross-government initiative that's looking at the future of the Nungera groundwater system that provides 60% of potable water for our public water supply and about 80% of the total water across the Perth region. The overarching framework being developed by the GSS will help to balance water, land, environmental issues, and involves many stakeholders, probably many of you in the room. A key aspect of this initiative is creating a transparent decision-making process in which trade-offs can be made. Ongoing management requires a governance structure that enables change in a responsible and accountable manner. So in summary, climate change and unprecedented growth will continue to increase pressure on freshwater resources. Actions to mitigate and adapt climate change are critical. Competition for water has intensified, but market mechanisms and institutional reforms will take time to mature. Successful implementation of reforms requires continued investment in water resources. The water industry is growing and evolving quickly. And water for future economic growth will increasingly rely on innovation, cooperation, and good governance. We need to be part of the solution. Thank you.